Good morning and welcome to the Atlanta Business Radio Show. I'm Amy Otto, joined by Lee Cantor. Good morning, Lee.
Good morning, Miss Amy. How are you doing this fine, fine day?
I'm great. It's beautiful out.
Yes, this morning. It's perfect.
Took a run with the dogs and I didn't even work up a sweat. It was so nice and cool.
So does that count then as exercise if you don't sweat?
It definitely counts as exercise if I don't sweat, but it's beautiful out. Loving the weather because it got so hot so fast it seemed.
And yeah.
Now we actually are getting a nice little spring. I'm excited about our show today, Lee, because, you know, we talk a lot about breast cancer and you hear it. You see the pink ribbons everywhere. But we sometimes forget about the men. And prostate cancer is actually the most common form of cancer among American men. And it's projected that 220,000 men will be diagnosed with this disease and more than 27,000 could die from prostate cancer. So this morning we have Dr. James Benton with us. I'm thrilled about that. He's with the Radiotherapy Centers of Georgia. Welcome to the Atlanta Business Radio Show.
Well, thanks. I'm glad to be here.
So Dr. Benton, who needs to worry about prostate cancer? I mean, a lot of times folks think that it's only old men. Who needs to worry about it?
Actually, all men. Prostate cancer is most common in elderly men. About two-thirds of men with prostate cancer will be 65 years or older. Having said that, we have seen men as young as 36 or as old as 92. Men should really start be screening for prostate cancer at the age of 50. However, if you have a family history, or if you're African-American men, you should start at the ages of 40 to 45.
So how'd you catch that 36-year-old?
Well, he had a very strong family history. I have a number of uncles, his dad. So there was some genetic issues going on there. And he got a PSA, which is an acronym for prostate-specific antigen. It's a very simple blood test, and it was elevated in his case. He had a biopsy, and he was diagnosed with cancer.
Yeah. I gotta ask. So the PSA is a way of testing for prostate cancer, but is there a digital rectal? Walk us through that process.
Yeah, when you think in terms of screening for prostate cancer, but just like you screen for colon cancer or breast cancer, there are basically two tests. One is a blood test, the PSA,
right,
and the second is what we call the DRE, which is a digital rectal exam. And it's important to combine both of those tests because about 20% of men with prostate cancer will have a normal PSA.
And how do you define normal?
Normal, just in simple terms, is a PSA less than 4. Mm-hmm. But I would caution you because the PSA really depends on the age of the patient. If you're 45 years old, your PSA really shouldn't be higher than 2.5. A PSA of 4 is normal in someone 65 to 70, so it's age-dependent.
And also, isn't it that that's kind of a benchline number that you could still be below 4 or even 2.5, but if you 1 year have a 1 and then the next year you have a 1.9, you still might be underneath that 2.5, but that would be a cause of concern.
That's a very excellent point. What he's talking about is a PSA velocity. So if your PSA doubles, irrespective of the absolute value, within 10 months, that is a sign of some concern. So, for example, if you had a PSA of 0.5 and now it's 1.2 1 year later, that in itself may be an indication that something may be going on and needs to be investigated.
So I've heard in the past that a gentleman will go for his regular physical. He goes in, the doctor examines him, does the digital rectal exam, and then he goes for his blood work after the PSA, or the PSA is done after the digital rectal. Is there any chance that stimulating the prostate can cause that to rise, just out of curiosity?
It's an excellent question. The question is, are there any benign conditions that could be contributing to an elevated PSA? Yes. A digital rectal exam, you want to actually get your PSA before you manipulate the prostate. Sexual activity can cause your PSA to go up. Or if you're an avid bike rider, anything that can irritate the prostate could cause the PSA to go up, even though it's a benign condition.
So what causes prostate cancer? Do we know?
I think we'll get the Nobel Peace Prize if anyone ever discovers
well,
or causes.
But isn't
but I can tell you there are a number of confounding factors. That mm-hmm. is, it's not one specific cause of prostate cancer. I think it's a combination of a number of factors. A genetic predisposition, your diet, your environment, being exposed to, for example, Vietnam-era veterans, Agent Orange has been linked to prostate cancer, certain chemicals. But ultimately, I think it's a combination of all of those factors.
And there's lots of different kinds of treatments now. Can you walk us through some
sure.
of those options?
There's at least 13 or 14 different kinds
wow.
of treatments for prostate cancer. From a very benign condition, something called watchful waiting. It is the only cancer in which watchful waiting is one option because most prostate cancers are very slow-growing cancers. Not all, but most.
Mm-hmm.
You have radical prostatectomy, and you have various kinds of radiation.
Mm-hmm.
All of those carry certain risks. Because whenever you treat prostate cancer, men really want to know two issues. What's my cure rate and what type of quality of life I'm going to have after this treatment?
Right.
So depending on those treatments, some will give you a high cure rate and a high quality of life. But the main two treatments in this country will either be surgery or radiation.
Is there another method you would recommend?
Well, watchful waiting is.
Watchful waiting is one. There's cryotherapy. Freezing the prostate is another. There is a technology that the FDA, the Food and Drug Administration, is currently reviewing called HIFU, H-I-F-U. And it's an acronym for High Intensity Focused Ultrasound. That's a very early preliminary treatment option, so we don't know the long-term results. But those are the main options.
Interesting. Now, how do you know if someone's cured?
Well, we define cure as a very specific number with your PSA. Remember, we go back to the PSA. A PSA is a marker. The only organ in the body that makes PSA is the prostate gland. Normal prostate will make PSA. So after you've undergone treatment, irrespective of that treatment, surgery, radiation, cryotherapy, the goal is to get your PSA to 0.2 or less. And that's how we define cure at 10 years.
How, when a person does the watchful waiting, which obviously is the less invasive of any of them,
right.
because you're doing nothing. You're just watching and waiting, right?
Well, it's we call it active surveillance. And the question is, what are you watching for and how long are you waiting?
Right.
What they're really watching for is men, say if you're 70 years old and you walked into my office and you got a PSA of 4.8, we do a biopsy, we discover you have a small, tiny area of prostate cancer, but you came into my office with an oxygen tank and you've
right.
had three heart attacks. You're not going to suggest treatment in that gentleman. Essentially, you're waiting to see if there are other comorbidities that one will
right.
die from as opposed to their prostate. So you would have to be followed 3 to 4 times a year. And some organizations suggest you get a second biopsy to make sure that prostate cancer that is slow-growing is not fast-growing.
Right.
But you do have to be watched very closely.
But isn't watchful waiting a choice normally of somebody who's much younger, that they don't want to do something invasive, that they don't want to affect their, you know, it's the balance of quality of life with dealing with a slow-moving cancer.
Sure.
So you're trying to wait for that sweet spot to be, okay, you can start messing around with that right when we get near the danger zone rather than too premature.
Well, that's the trick. You don't
right.
know when you're going to get to
right.
that danger zone.
So that's why it's watchful waiting.
So,
it's not just waiting.
And the recommendation is if, and this is very dangerous to guess, but they're trying to determine whether or not you have 10 years or longer to live in terms of watch. If they estimate that you have longer than 10 years,
right.
watchful waiting may not be the best option.
Mm-hmm. Wow.
What would be the option then?
Some one of those treatments.
Yeah,
one of the treatments that we talked about. Because essentially, prostate cancer, if you leave it alone, some of those cancers will become aggressive.
Right.
You don't know which one. Mm-hmm.
And it may happen, it may not.
And you don't want to wait. Cancer, by definition, will leave its site of origin and spread to other organs.
Right, as quickly as it can. That's its agenda.
And that's what you do not want to do.
Right.
So you have to be careful with watchful waiting and who you select for watchful waiting.
How can people learn more about prostate cancer? Is there an informational website that you recommend?
There are tons of websites. I'll give you my preference because this is where we work. But if you go to curingprostatecancer.com, it's tons of information. You can also go to rccancer.com or rcog.com. Or if you Google prostate cancer, it gives you a whole bunch of websites on which you can get volumes of information.
That's what always scares me, though, is when you Google. There's so, many.
There's so many.
I always want to know the ones that are best. And where are your offices?
We have a number of offices. We actually have 7 throughout Metro Atlanta, but the main office is off of Lawrenceville Highway, 2349 Lawrenceville Highway in Decatur. We have one in Conyers. We have one in Covington. We have one in Cummings. We have one in Canton, and we have one in Snellville.
Wow.
But let's talk about, just for a minute, your signature prostate cancer treatment that you recommend.
Right. Now, we recommend a very specific treatment. We have been treating prostate cancer since the late 70s. Dr. Christ started this organization called the Radiotherapy Clinics of Georgia. And he really thought somewhat out of the box in terms of how he treat prostate cancer. And there's a terminology you will see if you go online called prostacision. And what that means is that we use a very specific technique where we put radioactive seeds within the prostate. And in 3 weeks, we follow that with a very sophisticated computer-driven external beam radiation. That combination is called prostacision. And we have probably one of the largest database in terms of following men in the U.S. because we've treated just under 14,000, just under 14,000 men over those many years, and we follow them for the rest of their lives.
Wow.
And so men do quite well. The cure rate is probably one of the highest cure rates reported in the U.S., because we have such vast amount of experience among the 5 or 6 physicians who perform this technique.
Wow. So tell me a little bit more about the seeds. Am I saying they're like seeds?
Like little BBs, right?
Yeah.
Really?
Radiation is a natural substance. We don't make them. I mean, they come from planet Earth. And so there are all kinds of radiation seeds that we can use. They're a little tiny. If you can think in terms of the dimensions, they're only about 3.5 millimeters in length.
Wow.
So they're smaller than a grain of rice, and they give off a cloud of radiation within a perimeter around the seeds. Those seeds, every seed, have something what we call a half-life. For example, we use a seed called I-125, but there's palladium, there's gold, there's cesium. The only difference is that the half-life is different. They give off the radiation quicker.
Mm-hmm.
We have one that has a half-life of 2 months. So, for example, day one, it has 100% of its activity. Day 60, it has 50%. And day 120, it has 25%, 12.5%. And it takes about 4 to 5 half-lives to get out of the system. And it's patient and physician preference, but those seeds are permanent, okay?
Mm-hmm.
They
mm-hmm.
stay there, but the activity of those seeds will go away in about 10 months. And it's a very effective way of treating prostate cancer because you're getting high dose of radiation where the cancer cells reside within the mm-hmm. prostate, but they have such a fall off that you get very limited dose to those very critical surrounding structures,
right.
Like your rectum, your bladder,
right.
And the nerves for erections.
That makes a lot of sense.
Right.
A lot of valuable information, Dr. Benton. Thanks for sharing with us today. Is there a website for your company or a way that folks can reach out to learn more?
yeah, if you go to curing, like cure, curingprostatecancer.com, or if you call 404-320-1550, you'll get tons of information.
Terrific. Thanks so much for being with us today.
Sure.
Our next guest this morning, Lee, I'm anxious to hear all about this because sometimes I do a lot of research and sometimes I just wait and I'm surprised.
Yes. Which is this?
Yes. This is the wait and be surprised because I'm not really even sure what he does. But welcome to the Atlanta Business Radio Show, James Purcell, who's the president of Georgia Healthcare Leadership Council. Welcome.
Thank you, Amy. It's a pleasure to be here this morning.
So I could think all kinds of things when I hear Georgia Healthcare Leadership Council, but tell us, what is it?
A nonprofit organization for large self-insured employers, and the mission is that of healthcare policy. And our latest venture is in the area of price transparency, giving the tool to the employee to make a price conscious decision on healthcare services.
Wow. Yeah, it's right up my alley. Okay, so how did you get involved with the Healthcare Leadership Council, and is it new?
It's been around about 14, 15 years.
That's not so new.
No, it's not. We were the first in the country to roll out the LeapFrog reporting program for hospital reporting infection rates and physician order entry and a lot of things centered around patient care, quality of care.
Sure. And we just heard from a fabulous doctor in the area. Walk us through a little bit. How does your what you're doing affect, let's say positively affect, physicians in the medical community?
Well, we'll go straight to the providers. what happens is we eliminate networks.
Okay.
So no more networks. So from a provider standpoint, their credentialing aspect will go away. And it's a very people-intensive process, very expensive to the provider to comply with all the various plan requirements for credentialing.
Mm-hmm.
So that piece disappears. If they are effectively efficient in pricing their services, and this is for episodes of treatment from a physician standpoint and for a procedure from a hospital standpoint, then they're reimbursed at a higher rate.
Okay.
If they are not, the employer is in full charge of the medical fee schedule.
So let's back up.
Sure.
Let's talk about someone being self-insured. What does that mean? A corporation is self-insured. Explain that.
1,000 employees are higher,
mm-hmm.
but they have typically contracted with your traditional health plans, a Blue Cross, United, Aetna, those types, or an independent third-party administrator that services that employer in paying claims.
Okay. And define transparent pricing. Give us an example.
In the debate that has been going on for the last couple of years, everyone talked about it, but no one could get across the political boundaries of implementing something that made a difference on the individual's pocketbook.
Mm-hmm.
Employers are raising deductibles, copays, all those sorts of things. What our process flow applies is a decision-making process on the part of the employer as to how they're going to reimburse the provider based on their price efficiency, and then also with those higher deductibles, HSA plans, those types of insurance programs, they will make a price-conscious decision as to how they're going to spend their health care dollar.
You know, they say that people research their summer vacation or the purchase of a TV a whole lot more than they research their health care, and I think that's really true.
Yeah, it's word of mouth.
Yeah.
This is a good provider.
Is your organization advocating for the end user, the employee, or the employer?
It benefits both. The employee has the ultimate decision as to who their provider is going to be. When you eliminate the networks, there's no more decision-making process of in-network, out-of-network, those mind-numbing process flows you go through. The employer does the decision-making as to how the provider is going to be reimbursed.
Wow, that sounds interesting. So how long have you been with the Leadership Council?
Started it.
Oh, you're kidding.
Yes.
So what spurred you to start it? What was the pain you were feeling that you felt that this would solve?
It's in its early iteration, it was the Georgia Managed Care Association. And managed care is not an appropriate name. So the large employer said, let's change the name and raise our influence to a little larger level.
It does make, I mean, it allows enough area that it made me curious. Managed care, I don't know that that would have. So give us a snapshot on your feelings or your thoughts or how you're advocating for the current healthcare.
Right, you might have heard that there's some healthcare things in the news.
Just a few. The lucky aspect of what we've been devising over the last couple of years is that the new federal statute does not impact us. In fact, it probably would make things a little more encouraging for use, because if you look at the that 2,700-page document, there is a classification of various health plans that go from gold down to bronze. And if you hit the bronze category, it truly reflects the health savings account contribution level, in that an individual will have almost $6,000 out-of-pocket expense, family almost $12,000, and this is under the new federal plan.
Mm-hmm. I know.
Wow.
I think a lot of people
becoming real money,
that.
Huh?
Exactly.
Yeah. So you want to be careful with how you make those decisions to get your services.
Now, what's a tip for an employee that they could make a better decision? Do you have any suggestions? Is there anything they could do if they're, you know, working for one of these companies?
One of the things they could do is ask their human services or human resource officers to contact us, and we will show them how they can reduce their health care expenditure by about 20%.
What's the first step you take in that? Say an employer contacts mm-hmm. you. What's yeah. the? How do you take them through the process of actually saving these dollars?
We have a website. It's ghlc.org. And the employer can request a demo, and there are four tools that they can go through. The first is a 13-minute video that walks through the entire process as to how we produce the savings, what it runs through, the length of time, and all the various services that they get from a video standpoint. The next component is a demonstration of the interaction the employee has with choosing that provider. They choose their region of the state. They choose the state as a whole. They choose their type of provider they're searching for. And it comes back based on our analytics of the price paid in that market, what their expected price might be. And that's contingent upon what the employer decides to reimburse that provider on based on efficiency. And we've built the algorithms and everything else to determine that.
How do you make money?
Offer the service for a very nominal charge to the employer. It's it's an overlay to their existing service. So they typically give a 30-day notice to their third-party administrator and saying that this is now the way we're going to reimburse for your health services.
Are there any competitors?
Not that I'm aware of. Not in this arena.
Wow. Okay. And is this specific to Georgia?
It's under the Georgia Healthcare Leadership Council, but it's marketed nationally under the Monocle Health Data brand. Monocle is the driving engine behind the analytics and the outcome produced from the program.
Okay. Gosh.
Well, sounds like worth checking into.
Definitely. I got to watch that video. I regret now not watching it beforehand. Because
should have went the other way.
I should have. Although then I'd never be able to stop. We'd be on here for hours.
On the site, there are five videos that are public access. So you can go to the site and view all of the videos that give you.
So what's your gut feeling about this healthcare situation? Is this a net win for individuals?
It's going to be a very expensive proposition all the way around.
Mm-hmm.
We'll have to see where it goes.
We'll see where this goes.
That was a good response, by the way.
It sounds like he's been in politics.
Well, and he's got 30 years of insurance experience. You've seen a lot of change. What's the biggest change you've seen? I mean, go back. 30 years? That's a long time ago. It was before HIPAA. And all that stuff.
That was 96. So that's and HIPAA's, you know, its original intent was for sharing of information between providers, not these personal security that it's picked up the mantle for.
So come on, I'm not gonna stop. Tell you tell me biggest change, or maybe just tell us a story, something that, you know, how things have changed for you over the last 30 years in this business.
A lot of things have not changed. It's just a lot of new players. There's a lot of things that that sound good for the public, but usually when those pronouncements are made, they have not considered the economic consequences of those changes. And you can apply those in just about every area of life. But from the insurance standpoint, you can mandate all kind of benefits you want. Somebody's got to pay for it. And an insurance company traditionally is known as a payer. Well, in true fact, they do not manufacture the money. The money comes from the employer, the employee. Mm-hmm. It also comes from the employer-employee for Medicaid and Medicare.
Right.
And people miss that.
Yeah, you're right. That's definitely true.
Yeah.
What do you think a good return is on premium? I mean, say an insurance company pays out, how many cents on the dollar do you think would be typical?
Their margin, the profit margin is 2 or 3%. And, you know, the new statutory requirements under the federal law says that they've got to pay at least 80% out for a large group. And they've got to pay 85% out in on the personal, or the individual and the small group. So it's a scramble now as to what constitutes a claim.
Wow, yeah.
Now, what about the wellness component of this? A lot of this is built around we're trying to make the individual healthier and more compliant to healthful living. Are you seeing any ramifications of this to improve the actual the health of the employees?
You can't really measure it. I mean, it's quality indicators. We have substantial links on our site. Once you see the price, we've got the links to get to the quality pieces. But no one has put a dollar value on the quality. It's not good. It's not bad. It's just no one can put a price around it. What we have done is simply address the price of service.
Okay. But on the wellness component, like Lee was asking, if you're talking about the pharmacotherapy piece or you're looking to create healthier employees, that reduces the claims and the need for someone to go to the doctor. Are you guys addressing that at all?
We have about 60 reports we provide to the employer that takes their work population and their claims dollars, and it breaks it down by gender, by age. And it really gives a tool for that employer to decide which wellness programs or chronic disease programs they're supplying, which age sectors of their employee workforce, what works best and who needs it more.
That's interesting. That's a baby step, too. If you look at the census and it's a trucking company and there are a lot of smokers, start with smoking cessation.
Right.
Take small steps. That's a great idea. Any final thoughts for our listeners? Give us the website another time, and just any final thoughts or words of motivation to get us through this healthcare crisis, I guess.
I like to refer to this as the retailization of healthcare and healthcare services. And the website is ghlc.org. And one of the outcomes, because this is a measurement of a full episode of treatment by the provider, the comment I always hear from a provider is, I always get the sickest of the sick. Well, that may be true, but if you are only getting them at the end of the episode, you're not counted in our statistical values. So we're looking at the full treatment and episode of treatment and a full procedure. One thing we expect to come from this, especially in the hospital setting, is that you're going to see them starting to advertise, like the advertisement I got on my BlackBerry yesterday, LASIK surgery for $299. I started out at $2,000 an eye, and the price has dropped precipitously since then. So we expect to see a hospital has got surgery beds open on Thursday and Friday, and
like a special on open heart surgery.
Hey, here it is. Schedule one member per family this week only,
right?
But a blue light special, if you will. But you will see that kind of advertising occur with the healthcare providers.
Wow.
Interesting. Well, I do know one thing for sure. If I have cancer issues, I'm not going to go for the special. I'm going to call up Dr. Benton.
Absolutely. But that's your choice.
Exactly. Right. And it is nice to have choices like that. And you know what, y'all? I just said healthcare crisis, did I not? Shame on me. Healthcare reform, healthcare situation, issue, crisis isn't a good word for that, right?
I would not. I wouldn't agree with that.
No comment. Well, thanks for being with us today, James. And we hope our listeners will reach out, especially if you're a human resource director in that larger sector. Definitely worth looking at and educating yourself on what the options are currently available. So thank you for being with us today.
Thanks.
It seems like that whole wellness thing, it just all roads lead back to the wellness and creating the healthy employees.
Right. And that's, often neglected.
It is.
Talked about a lot, It's not actually executed.
Children's Healthcare of Atlanta recently had a big push towards wellness and, right. and weight loss, and they drove a Hummer onto the lot and mm-hmm. showed that their employees collectively had lost 10,000 pounds, the weight of the Hummer.
Wow.
That's pretty cool. That's
a nice promotion.
Yeah, it really is. And plus it develops this camaraderie, and there's so much going on with healthcare right now, and having options like this. And I mean, you think about it, you go for blood work. If you've got insurance, you don't know how much it costs. You don't know if it's covered. Sometimes.
No, that's the thing that drives me crazy, is that you have no clue if something costs a lot, a little, if one provider is twice the price of the other provider, you have no idea at all.
Yeah.
It's right. like getting dry cleaning done.
It is, although I don't know that I would always go for the special, especially no. if it's my vision.
It's like the same, that's where I feel about, like, discount sushi. It's hard for me to go buy one, get one free, you know?
Yes,
I'd rather
you're right.
pay top dollar.
You are so right. But there's one thing, Lee, that I am going to be looking into soon, and I'll probably be pricing around, and that's, like, hearing aids. I am so hard of hearing. And it's some of the newer hearing aids are so small, you don't even see them. So,
right.
You know, the fact that you have to repeat things to me, it's not that I'm not listening. I just can't hear.
That's what happens to you rock and roll people.
It's yeah, rock and roll. It's all those years on the tractor when
Is
I was a kid.
What, we'll go with that. Yeah. Instead of all those rock concerts you went to in your teens.
I actually had a stereo chair.
That probably helped.
Yeah, it was like a big egg, and I would sit
right?
in there and listen to my AC/DC.
Your
and
parents were hippies?
No,
my
parents were intolerant of noise.
So
they
kept
stuck
it
me
self-contained.
In, yeah, in a little cage.
They couldn't give you headphones?
No. I don't know that they had those way back when. Our next guest this morning can help shed some light on my hearing issue and the resources that are available. Welcome to the Atlanta Business Radio Show. We have the folks from the Auditory Verbal Center. Welcome.
Thank you.
Thank you for having us.
So it looks like we have Jonathan, and is it Beth and Debbie? Terrific.
We need less nodding and more talking.
Yeah. No, there's lots of you and not everybody's talking. So I'm anxious to hear all about the Auditory Verbal Center. Let us know what it is.
The Auditory Verbal Center is a nonprofit center that with a vision of bringing people who are deaf or hard of hearing into a lifetime of hearing. What this means is we start with an audiology clinic. And we service anybody from birth to seniors with diagnostic testing, dispensing of hearing aids, special ear molds for swimming, for musicians. Then we also have our auditory verbal therapy program. This is the program that we teach deaf to hard of hearing how to hear and speak without the use of sign language or lip reading. We literally take the visual away from the child and teach them to understand spoken language the same way you and I learned to hear, to detect sound, discriminate it, identify it, comprehend it. When these children graduate from our program, they are age-appropriate expressively and receptively to their hearing peers, needing no additional help other than their own hearing equipment.
And Beth, you're the co-founder. Tell us a little bit, how did you start this? I mean, you don't just sit around and dream something like this up. You really have to have passion behind it.
You do. I taught for 5 years in what was called an oral school, and that was where they taught primarily lip reading. And at the same time, a professor out of Canada was coming up with a lot of acoustic information and how we could better access hearing. And what that could do. And obviously we learn to speak normally because we speak what we hear. It's very difficult to teach lip reading or to teach sign language and have that take the place. But at the same time, I met a young woman who was in charge of the infant program at this same school, and she herself was profoundly deaf. She and her brother were born profoundly deaf. And they both were in an experimental program. It was then called the unisensory approach. Or the acoupedic approach, and they both spoke wonderfully. They used the telephone. They both had their doctorates. Ellen actually had hers in deaf education. And so when I left to have my second child, Ellen was also leaving this particular school, and she said, why don't we start a school based on the approach that I was raised on.
Wow.
And so we did.
That's a great story. Now, do you primarily work with children or folks of all ages?
Well, at the center, we work with children.
Okay.
Because the key is to get these children identified in infancy through the neonatal screening at the hospitals, and then get proper referrals and get them as early as possible so that we can get some amplification in via hearing aids, maybe for a little while before we evaluate for an implant. But, and Debbie, you can speak to the youngest age of,
right.
of implant.
Georgia now mandates that every child is tested for a hearing loss before they leave the hospital. So our youngest client in the auditory verbal program is could be as young as 2 months old.
Wow.
Once you can fit somebody with hearing aids. We service anybody from birth to seniors for audiology, but the auditory verbal program is strictly the children from about 2 months to 5 years of age.
How does a parent identify at that young age if your child needs some sort of hearing help?
Great question. They do a what they call auditory brainstem response, an ABR, and they do this at the hospital where they're measuring sound brain waves to sound.
Mm-hmm.
So they're able to detect at birth whether there's a hearing loss. Then you go for a follow-up 3 months later, at the most 3 months later, confirm that hearing loss, get fitted with hearing aids, and then into some kind of
So program. Is that just standard when a child's born they do
yes.
this test?
In the state of Georgia it is.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And did you know that in 2007 CDC announced that hearing loss was the number one birth defect in the United States?
Really?
Hearing loss is more common than you realize. It's no longer about our seniors getting old. There's actually more deaf adults between 40 and 50 because of the concerts and boom boxes and
yes,
that kind of thing.
She's talking to you, you know.
What? No, it really is. It's I know that that's the case, and you always think of you know, someone that can't hear very well being older, but it affects
I'm sure the iPods are good for your business.
They are. We're seeing record numbers of young adults coming in with the beginning stages of hearing loss. I do want to say on the auditory verbal program, this is a family education program. So we're educating the family on how to raise this child, anybody from mild to profoundly deaf. They come once a week to our center for therapy. We give them lesson plans. The therapist will give them lesson plans to go home and continue doing therapy every day, an hour a day at home. We have two locations, one in Macon and one in Atlanta.
Now, isn't there some controversy amongst the deaf community about the, lip reading is good or bad? Or there are people are very passionate about this, isn't that right?
Yes, they are very passionate. And it's just a different philosophy. They see life one way. We
right.
believe in teaching. We have nothing against sign language. And what we tell our families is that once you've learned to hear and speak, then you can learn sign language once you leave our program.
Mm-hmm.
It'd be like you and I learning Spanish or any other foreign
right.
language.
Mm-hmm.
But when you're in the program, give the child the opportunity.
You have to be all in.
You have to be all in.
You can't be halfway.
Right. No visual cues. And the
right.
window of opportunity is birth to five. You can't do this type of approach with a 16-year-old who's lived deaf culture
right.
all their life.
Just like it would be harder to learn a foreign language when you're
right.
16 as opposed to if you were born
right.
and raised mm-hmm. with that environment.
So I can't wait to hear from Jonathan. Jonathan, you're a graduate of the Auditory Verbal Center. Tell
yes,
us about
ma'am.
The experience.
I got my cochlear implant when I was about 5 years old, and I graduated from the center around when I was 6 years old. I have barely enjoyed everything I've learned, and I've been able to hear and speak just like every one of you guys,
mm-hmm.
and I recently just graduated from Riverside Military Academy.
Wow.
And so being able to wear the cochlear implant, being part of the hearing world, has been a great benefit for me and helping all the other deaf children.
Absolutely. So what was that like? I mean, I think about that. You're 5 years old, and up to that point, you haven't heard. Then you have your implant, and you go through this program. I mean, how old were you when you actually were able to hear much better?
Well, first, when I was born, I started wearing hearing aids,
okay.
and I wasn't really able to understand sound that well.
Okay.
So my mother did some research and found that there was a cochlear implant, and she decided that's the best choice for me, and we decided to go with that. And so I was able to hear after that.
Okay, so it you had hearing aids before, so it wasn't like you couldn't hear then, but it just got so much better?
Yes, ma'am.
It's almost like, only thing I can think of is if you get contacts or glasses, right. And it's like, oh my goodness, I can't even see to drive, and then you put them on and everything's sharp. What was the one sound you enjoyed the most?
It was rock music, right?
I love listening to country, but I've always loved talking on the phone, being able to hear my friends from a distance, far away,
right,
and all that kind of stuff. So,
and I will tell you, that's what makes our approach different than others. These kids can talk on the phone because they're not dependent on the visual cues.
Right.
If you also notice his voice quality, mm-hmm. he doesn't have that deaf quality to his voice.
Right.
If you also notice the language structure, the complete sentences, the prefixes, the suffixes, the S's, the past tense, it's perfectly normal and age appropriate. And I just want to say another wonderful thing about our program is that parents don't have to bring a child every single day to a school and leave them all day long and then drag along siblings, for instance, or have somebody else care for the siblings. The child remains an integral part of their family, goes to their local preschool or the schools of the parents' choices, and they're fully integrated. It's a requirement because we want them listening to normal speech and language, mm-hmm. not the speech and language of other hearing-impaired children.
Sure.
We had an elderly person in our neighborhood who got a hearing aid for the first time, and he was like, oh, all of a sudden I hear birds. Like, like what happens when the hearing slowly goes away, you're losing stuff you don't realize. It's incremental.
Exactly.
And then when the change happens, it's dramatic.
You typically lose your high-frequency sounds. Mm-hmm. Those are, you know, the sound is transmitted through the cochlea via these little hair cells, and they're mm-hmm. very delicate. And the ones for the higher
are the first to go.
Are the first to go.
Mm-hmm.
And yes, it can impede your work situation or your marriage situation.
Right. Yeah, sure.
You know, and you really don't know what you're missing.
Right.
But in the case of someone being born deaf, the technology is here with the implant. I have now lived long enough to watch the evolution of a hearing aid, which was very crude when I first taught. They were worn on the body. They were big boxes. They had wires that the children would get all tangled up in. And
mm-hmm.
Not effective, as effective as the ear, then what became the ear level.
Right.
And then those, they just sort of amplified sound the
just
same
indiscriminately,
way.
Indiscriminately, right.
Yes. And then, of course, they came up to the digital ones that could be fitted more to the child's hearing loss. And now we have this implant, which is just miraculous. I mean, we've been doing this approach at this center for 32 years, and we did it with hearing aids with profoundly deaf children, which was difficult. And people would say, oh, it's cruel. Oh, they can't do it. Well, they did it, and their speech.
But why would it be cruel?
Well, because we took away the visual cues.
Right.
And made them listen.
Right.
You can plateau pretty fast with signing.
Mm-hmm.
And with lip reading, but you plateau.
Right.
You don't keep going mm-hmm. with language acquisition. And the older that you get, the less concrete you get with language. You know, mm-hmm. we use nouns first. Babies learn nouns first, and then we get into verbs, and then we get into subtleties in language.
Right.
And tenses, and et cetera, et cetera. So really, the best way to learn language is to be able to hear it. I mean, you can't hear intonation. You can't hear. I mean, you can't see intonation. You can't see volume. You can't see the difference between a B and a P and various other and an M, for instance. They all look the same.
Sure.
So we were, you know, trying to access the hearing way back when with what we called auditory training. But
the technology's improved.
Oh, my goodness.
Dramatically.
The technology is here. And mm-hmm. Really, I feel that everybody should be afforded the opportunity.
It's a choice,
this.
You know, and let the person or the parent make this decision. Now, technology-wise, where do you see it evolving to? Is it going to just keep getting smaller and better?
I think
absolutely.
So.
Absolutely. The technology, they're already, the cochlear implant's getting smaller. I think they're going to probably start working on more of a totally implantable device.
Mm-hmm.
Even hearing aids, they're so minute now versus what they were when Beth was
right.
starting on.
So the cochlear implant that you have, Jonathan, it just stays in. I mean, I'm ignorant on this, so walk me through the process. I mean, just tell me a little bit more about it, maybe.
Okay, so what happens is when you first get your cochlear implant, they give you in the surgery and you put in this little magnet device that my mom can probably explain it a lot better than I can, so I'll let her do that.
It's a receiver and a magnet with a tail type thing that feeds into your cochlea. They recess this in your mastoid bone just under the skin. Mm-hmm. On the outside of the head is a device that's a size of a quarter that is a magnet that literally magnetizes to the piece that's been recessed in
your skull. It matches, right? They lock together.
And then there's a wire that goes down to a processor that looks like a hearing aid that sits on his ear. So sound goes in that processor, converts to electric impulse, electric current, back up that wire through the magnet to that receiver through the connections in the cochlea to the brain. That's how he's hearing. It's the implant is able to take all the sounds. Hearing aids amplify. They get really, really loud, but then they cut off. They cannot get loud enough to hear those high frequencies that speech comes from. So when you're profoundly deaf, you get the cochlear implant, and it is taking all the sounds and transmitting it to you.
Wow, that's fascinating.
Now, when at night or when he's around water, whatever, when the magnet is off the head, there's no sound.
Right. So you can go swimming, or you just take it off to go in the swimming?
Yes. Whenever I take a shower, I go swimming, I go to the lake, I just take it off, and I just won't be able to hear anything. But
right. So that works, too. I wish
they
I had that
good,
sometime.
Let me tell you. At nighttime.
I know. That
seems like real well.
It's great when there's thunderstorms and everything.
Yeah. That would be great if someone's snoring, no doubt.
You need that, right?
Yeah.
Your husband.
Oh, my goodness. Gosh. And I know you're non-profit, so how can our listeners help?
Help us spread the word. Too many people don't know that children born with a hearing loss from mild to profoundly deaf can learn to hear and speak. We really need folks out there to help us spread the word, educate the public. And, of course, we could always use funding. That's a huge thing with the nonprofit. I don't know if you're aware of this, but insurance doesn't pay for hearing aids. So money that we raise helps us.
Why wouldn't they pay for hearing? What would be the? Oh, because they think that it's free to learn sign language.
Yeah. Right, exactly. That population had lobbied many years ago. They deem it as a quality of life issue rather than a medical necessity. We're working very hard in getting things turned around, but in the meantime, you know, an average set of hearing aids is $5,000.
Wow.
I don't know about you, but that's a lot of money to me.
Yeah.
So we're, through money that we raise, we offer scholarships, discounts on the hearing aids, and then the auditory verbal program, these children come once a week for 2 to 5 years. Insurance is paying a half of it. The Medicaid pays minimal. And so we're able to offer, again, scholarships and discounts. So 100% of the money that we raise goes towards a scholarship fund to offer this help to these children so that they can be independent communicators, just like Jonathan, living their dream. We have a graduate that is a fireman down in Clayton County, Station Number 4. Amazing. A profoundly deaf child is one of our firemen.
Wow.
Nothing these kids can't do when given the
chance. Right. Now, is it something that the hearing aids can be kind of recycled and that you can give it to another child of the same size, or is customized
it's programmed for that person. Now, hearing aids, the other thing people can do is turn in their hearing aids to us, which we take and turn in for credit dollars to buy new hearing aids.
But you can't reuse the same hearing aid.
You really can't reuse it.
Right.
We can program hearing aids. Everything's digital, but they really are tailored to that individual. But if you know anybody out there that has hearing aids, turn them in to us so we can get credit dollars, buy new hearing aids to give to families that just simply can't afford it.
Sure. Any final thoughts for us, for our listeners? And I definitely want you to give your website again.
Take care of your hearing. It's very valuable. You don't know how much you'll miss it until it starts dropping out. And kids with iPods, don't crank them up to maximum volume. And
what about
rock concerts take care of your ears?
No, what about in the elderly? Do you know? I don't know if this is a little off topic for you guys, but doesn't the VA help with hearing aids? Are you aware of any of the programs for the elderly?
Yes, but you have to be a veteran to be able to get benefits from it.
But there are opportunities for them to subsidize the cost of the hearing aid as they get older.
If you qualify through the VA will issue hearing aids to you.
Mm-hmm.
But if you weren't a veteran, you know, your family members, your wife might lose their hearing. You have to go seek help somewhere else.
And they're not the best on the market. My father-in-law got his hearing aids through the VA, and they definitely don't have the latest and greatest. But, you know, you're right. That is a help for someone in need.
We have very competitive prices through.
Right.
You might want to speak to that, how we get our hearing aids.
We dispense just about every manufacturer out there, but some of the things that make us unique is our three-year warranty, three-year loss and damage. We give free batteries. We're real big on, you know, the free trial for 30 days. During that time, you come once a week or every other week, because how you hear in the sound booth when we fit you.
Yeah, it's a little different than real life.
Exactly. And so we ask you to go home, see what it's like, come back. Let's readjust that hearing aid to fit your needs and your lifestyle. We're very aggressive, because without the hearing, nothing else is going to work. And so it's about living healthy, happy, and safe in our environment, which means being able to hear everything around us.
Right.
One thing that I'd like to say that's very important, should your child not be picked up in the neonatal screening process, often it happens that a child will lose its hearing later after that. But if a parent should suspect that their child is not hearing because they're not following directions or they're not talking at age-appropriate times, get a hearing test. Just don't leave it up to somebody to say, oh, they're just not mature enough, or they're taking it all in before it comes out, because it's very rare that a child will not respond properly to hearing or give you something back. I think with all the interest in autism now, we might be picking up on children with a lot of disabilities in terms of communication.
And you think that hearing might be at the crux of some of that?
Well, I don't know. I can't really speak to that. But I just think the attention that we're now paying to that, you know, we may even pick up on some other children with hearing loss. But don't hesitate. It's not that expensive to get a hearing test. And if your older child even flunks the hearing screening at school or before school age when they're required to get a full audiological exam. Mm-hmm. And then the other thing I want to say that we didn't say is that we have a follow-up program for adults who might get a cochlear implant. We have therapy for them. The brain really has to be trained to what it's hearing, because it is a mechanical device, and so it's a little bit different. So you have that adjustment period, and probably somebody who's gotten an implant hasn't been hearing for a good while, and your auditory memory can be affected of what that sound really sounded like, because you don't have it anymore.
Right.
So we offer that also for adults, and usually and you can correct me if I'm wrong, Debbie, but usually the people that get implants as adults are adults who have had hearing.
Mm-hmm. Exactly. And it's a matter of fine-tuning their hearing listening skills once they get the implant. So they're only going to come for therapy for, you know, about 3 months. But we do really encourage people to follow up. It's very inexpensive to get a hearing test. Don't let it go by. People that have babies that are diagnosed at birth, don't overlook that. Go for the follow-up test within a month. We do the newborn screening follow-up testing, unsedated, one of the few in the state that do that. It's just very, very critical that you follow up with the hearing loss.
You've got me hooked. I need to make my appointment. Because honestly, I don't think I've had my hearing checked since I was a kid.
That's probably what happens for most people, right?
Yes, right. You get tested at age 5.
Yeah, or at school even.
Yeah. Yeah, we go to have our eyes checked.
Right.
Regularly. But we don't check on our hearing.
Wow.
And there's a lot of, you know, high frequency loss people don't realize, and all of a sudden you're not hearing the birds. For little kids, their speech might be slurred, so you think it's just a speech impairment when actually it's
a hearing impairment.
It's a hearing impairment. Right.
I can't tell you how many times I lock my cats in the closet or in a cabinet, and I can't hear them. And my kids will come home and they'll be like, you know, gosh, Emma's in the cabinet. Really? How do you know? Don't you hear that? And I really don't hear them.
You know, they have a ringtone for the teenagers have that they can only hear that adults can't hear
because
it's a high pitched sound.
Really?
Yes. Wow. Well, all the things I'm missing out.
Teenagers and dogs.
Right. They have their own little way of communicating, so adults don't hear.
Exactly.
Amazing.
You
have a lot of ways with that, don't they?
Y'all, thanks so much for being with us today and
for sharing
your stories and information about the center. Amazing things that y'all are doing. Give us the website in case people have hearing aids to recycle or to turn into you, or if they're like myself and want to schedule an appointment with you.
Our website is www.avchears.org. And you can, and our phone number is 404-633-8911.
Excellent.
Great.
Thanks so much for being with us today.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Lee, wow. I was so interested in talking about this. We went over time. So thanks to our listeners for hanging in there and listening to the show today. Lots of valuable information. And until next week, I'm Amy Otto with the Atlanta Business Radio Show. Have a wonderful week.